Ani, welcome to Bom Sida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. An academic will be researching the connection of genocide to Canadian residential schools and Native American boarding schools. A digital stories project examines generational impacts of residential school and the relationship between mothers who attended those schools and their daughters. Cancer rates among First Nations have been steadily increasing, and the Canadian Cancer Society is focusing on prevention. The Right Honourable Paul Martin is the first recipient of a new Aboriginal Relations Award, and an organization is working to promote and support First Nation, Métis, and Inuit learning. All these stories, plus great tunes, all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. A First Nation in northwestern Ontario is battling prescription pill abuse. Martin Hills First Nation has launched a treatment program in the community to combat the drug abuse. Chief Eli Munias says the pill abuse started in the community in about the mid-1990s, and he's seen a lot happen during that time, from people losing their homes to hungry kids. Munias says an addiction is a sickness, and it needs to be treated for people to get well, and if left untreated, the result is death. Since there isn't a physician in the community, instead of a methadone program, a substitute drug known as Suboxone will be used in the treatment program along with counseling. Munia says about 60 people will be going through the treatment program over the next several months. The First Nation is located in the Ring of Fire area, is a fly-in community, and has about 600 members, half of which live on reserve. According to the Canadian Cancer Society, cancer rates among First Nation citizens have been on the rise over the past four decades. Because of that, the organization has held its first Aboriginal Approaches to Cancer Prevention Symposium. Shauna Pitawanakwit is the Lay Health Community Coordinator based in Ontario. Pitawanakwit says screening is key to prevention.
The main reason is that the Canadian Cancer Society Screening Saves Lives realizes the importance of screening, and that the Aboriginal community has an overall rate of cancers have doubled within the First Nation community since 1968 to 2001.
Kathy Burns, manager of the Sudbury and District Canadian Cancer Society, says the statistics of cancer rates among First Nations is hard to pinpoint, but it has been on the rise. Burns also says it's not known why cancer rates are up. Burns adds people can talk to their doctors about cancer screening programs. The Aboriginal Cancer Symposium was held in Manitoulin Island, Ontario, earlier this week. A couple of First Nations in Manitoba are suing the province and federal government in Manitoba Hydro over an unusual amount of flooding this year. The Winnipeg Free Press reports the Peguis and Ebb and Flow First Nations filed their lawsuits in Winnipeg earlier this month. In the statement of claim, the First Nations say their lands are no longer suitable for agriculture and are largely unfit for residents. The statement of claim also says the flooding damaged the commercial fishery, cultural grounds, burial grounds, and traditional medicines. Jeffrey Rath, Alberta lawyer, is representing the First Nations. He told media the First Nations are sick and tired of the government and utility company flooding hundreds of thousands of acres of land without concern to the First Nations in the province. Rath also said a conscious decision was made this spring to keep the Portage la Prairie dry and put Ebb and Flow underwater. Flooding in the province lasted into the summer this year, and many were forced from their homes in the spring. According to the Winnipeg Free Press, a statement of defense has not yet been filed. A scholar with the University of Manitoba is going across the border to begin research to look into the connection between genocide to Canadian residential schools and Native American boarding schools. Andrew Wolford is a professor of sociology. His research project is entitled A Tonic for Boarding School Blues, Genocide and Historical Redress in Canada and the U.S. Wolford says in the past, he wrote a theoretical paper on genocide, and he says it's a good time to bring that conversation back into the light.
I thought it was a timely study because we have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Winnipeg here. We have a Museum of Human Rights about to take root. So it seemed the time was ripe to get Canadians thinking about these things again, since I'm certainly not the first person to write about genocide in Canada. There are several other people we could name here, but I wanted to be part of sort of regenerating that discussion because I think it's an important discussion for Canadians to have.
Wolford says his paper will be ready next fall. The Prairie Women's Health Center of Excellence has launched its digital stories series, examining the intergenerational impacts of residential school. In particular, it focuses on First Nations women whose mothers are residential school survivors. Roberta Stout is a researcher in Aboriginal women's health and works with the Prairie Women's Health Center of Excellence in Winnipeg. She says the work was done through storytelling by six women, and it was there that there was a lot of realization moments for the women who participated in the project.
This was the first time that these women weren't being asked what was it like to be parented by a survivor of a residential school. So what are the intergenerational effects? And that telling stories is healing. So the women also talked about how for them being involved in a project like this where they were able to share their stories for the first time with other women who had very similar life experiences that they had growing up and continue to have, that there was this a connection that was made between each other, so they felt less alone. There was more of an understanding of the aha moments where it's like, oh, now I understand why my mom was the way she was, or now I understand why I am the way I am.
The 2 to 5 minute video stories can be viewed on the Prairie Women's Health Center of Excellence's website. The Dene and Yellowknife are protecting their land. The Dene are opposed to any mining projects in an area known as Dry Bones Bay. Media reports grave sites and thousands of year-old villages are spread around the area, and the Dene are opposed to mining activity in the area because of the historic nature of the site. Dene National Chief Bill Erasmus told media that First Nations are not generally anti-mining. He said the chiefs are not opposed to development, and they have supported the development of three diamond mines in the past, but anything new in the area doesn't make any sense. Dene leaders presented their case earlier this month to the Mackenzie Valley Environmental Impact Review Board, which held a public hearing into proposed diamond drilling along the bay. Ashoka International has launched its Changemakers Initiative. Through the initiative, the organization is looking for submissions that support and promote learning from early childhood to career education in First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities. Alicia Muscat is the executive director of Ashoka Canada. She says the initiative was launched because the organization had made it a point to include First Nations more.
We at Ashoka Canada have been focused on helping social entrepreneurs scale up their solutions to make systemic change. And when we looked at who the social entrepreneurs are or the Ashoka fellows that we work with, we definitely noticed that we wanted to be working more with Aboriginal peoples in Canada.
Muscat says Aboriginal learning projects can be nominated on the Ashoka's website. Then, a jury will award top projects, plus will organize a summit to showcase projects and possibly create partnerships. Former Prime Minister Paul Martin has been named the first recipient of a National Aboriginal Award. The Award for Excellence in Aboriginal Relations has been presented to Martin by the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business and Sodexo Canada. The award is presented to a Canadian who has personally contributed through his or her professional activity and voluntary commitments to building bridges between Aboriginal people and Canada's business community. Martin has been recognized for two of his own initiatives, the Martin Aboriginal Education Initiative, which aims to increase Aboriginal retention at post-secondary institutions, and the Capital for Aboriginal Prosperity and Entrepreneurship, or CAPE Fund. Martin says he's honored to be the first recipient of that award. Martin says working with the Aboriginal community has been and is important to him.
I really think that the issues that we're talking about in terms of Aboriginal Canada, these are among the most important social issues and the most important economic issues in the country. We're talking about the youngest, the fastest growing segment of our population. And the fact is that Canada hasn't stood up and dealt with them properly. And it was a tragedy that Kelowna was not carried through with. This was the first time that the federal government, provinces, territories, and the Aboriginal leadership sat down to deal with issues like health care and with education. And when I stepped down from government, I said, look, This is simply too important an issue. It's one I've been involved in for all my life, long before I went into public life. I was active with CCAB, and I just don't think there's any way, shape, or form that we can talk about Canadian values without facing up to this issue and working with the Aboriginal leadership and with Aboriginal Canadians to deal with what are, in many cases, human tragedies, but even more to the point, just unfulfilled opportunities for a very young and dynamic generation.
The recipient of the Award of Excellence in Aboriginal Relations is selected by a jury of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal business leaders. A Cree elder has passed away. Indian Country Today Media Networks reports Alma Kitawewit was a senator of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations and renowned ambassador of Cree culture, language, and tradition. Over a span of 21 years, Alma served as cookum or grandmother to more than 1,000 participants in the Bold Eagle program, an Army Reserve basic military qualification course offered to Aboriginal youth. She was mourned both locally and nationally. Funeral services were held September 21st for the 69-year-old cookum. Mary Simon, the president of the Inuit Tapuri Kanatami, has received the Governor General's Northern Medal Award. Simon received the award earlier this week at a ceremony in Quebec City. In a statement, ITK said Simon has been steadfast in advocating for social justice for Inuit during the course of her career and has worked for the rights of children and youth. And she has worked to improve education for Inuit across the Arctic, recently launched a national Inuit education strategy. Former Governor General Adrian Clarkson created the award in 2005 to recognize people whose work contributes to the evolution of the Canadian North and affirms its place as a part of Canadians' national identity. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
In the moonlight and found a little spark. I found it irresistible. I tremble all night long. She made me feel so like nothing could go wrong. And she said, got no hang-ups, she don't mind the rain. She make me smile, she make me feel no pain. This lonely little danger couldn't do no wrong. This lonely little stranger couldn't last that long. Oh,
was Ooh La La by Derek Miller, a cut from his album Dirty Looks. A scholar with the University of Manitoba is going across the border to begin research to look into the connection between genocide to Canadian residential schools and Native American boarding schools. Andrew Wolford is a professor of sociology.
The idea is that I'm going to do a comparative study of the two different boarding school experiences focused on specific regions, the southwest of the United States, and Manitoba, maybe some Saskatchewan in Canada. I want to focus local because I want to try to get at a quick picture of how these two areas differ. They're both areas with large Indigenous populations and that had quite a few schools, so they seemed good comparables. And I want to focus on local experiences of the schools, so that rather than being too broad and general, I could get at, you know, how these things looked in these two regions, how these schools looked, how they affected students, how they affected generations.
And so why do you want to do this project?
I wrote an article in 2009 that on making an argument for applying the term genocide to Canada. But one of the arguments there was we really need to look at local conditions, at local experiences, that too often genocide studies scholarship happens in a top-down manner. Sort of we define these things up top, and then we decide whether or not that applies to local people's experiences. But I thought that was problematic because, you know, groups happen on the ground. People define who experience their groups. They define what they are as groups. They negotiate their groupness on a day-to-day basis. And genocide, laws against genocide, are all about protecting the life of groups. And it's really hard to assess unless you know something about the life of these groups on the ground. So I wrote this paper sort of as an argument within the field of genocide studies because the Canadian case was often ignored. It wasn't seen as sort of comparable to the big cases of the Holocaust, Rwanda, Armenia. And I want to make an argument that the United Nations Genocide Convention, which is the typical measure, wasn't always an appropriate lens for understanding Indigenous experiences. That it's got built into it a lot of Eurocentric thinking. So in making this theoretical argument, I thought, well, I better follow it up and do something empirical to look at what's actually happening. And I thought it was a timely study because we have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Winnipeg here. We have a Museum of Human Rights about to take root. So it seemed the time was ripe to get Canadians thinking about these things again, since I'm certainly not the first person to write about genocide in Canada. There are several other people we could name here, but I wanted to be part of sort of regenerating that discussion because I think it's an important discussion for Canadians to have.
I don't know if you might know that recently a Mi'kmaq elder wrote a paper talking about genocide, and that Nova Scotia was a site of one of those was a scene of genocide, and that paper is being challenged in an academic journal, and some people are saying that, you know, like what your argument is, that no, it's not genocide, but then, you know, people have different opinions of what that means.
Yeah, like that is that Daniel Paul's work?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I think I find, you know, scholars like Daniel Paul and others who come forward, they're too quickly, people try too quickly to dismiss them in Canada, where I think they present some very serious arguments and about applying the term genocide to Canada. And we need more people entering the debate and entering the discussion. And so I hope to add to that.
Yeah, this is probably a hard question, but do you think some of those are dismissed because they're coming from Indigenous elders or Indigenous scholars?
I think that is really part of the problem. From my, you know, this is just not my academic viewpoint, but my point as an observer of these discussions, it seems that when Indigenous people come forward, it's seen as a polemic, you know, that they're, you know, trying to use this term politically. Whereas my experience, I did a research on the British Columbia Treaty process when I spoke to elders and people, the term genocide would often come up, and to me, they weren't using it in a polemical sense. They were using it in a sense to express what has happened to their communities because of land appropriation, because of residential school, because of, you know, all these experiences of colonialism that, you know, I'm interested in a broader sense. So I think that's the sort of, you know, safety measure Canadians have to kind of close off the debate and say, oh, you know, this is just political, when really, you know, there's a serious argument to be made here. And we need Indigenous elders, Indigenous scholars as part of the debate, since they're closer to the experience. Mm-hmm. I come from the world of genocide studies, so that field is shifting to, you know, consider cases like Canada, Australia, the United States more seriously. That's opening up in the field of genocide studies and becoming an important new area of research, but Canadian society hopefully will open up in the same way.
It is a very interesting debate on that. And then going back to your project, what kind of impact do you think that your project will have?
I think the impact of this project, part of it is looking at differing paths to repair as well. Because I think right now, from my little familiarity in the U.S., there's some, maybe even some envy of the Canadian reparations process that's happened through the Indian Residential School Settlement Act, whereas there's being very little happening on the U.S. side of things. They see this as a model. So I want to trace why the U.S. case hasn't received the attention in terms of reparations that the Canadians have, but also look at problems with the way in which Canadian reparations are unfolding and how this may not be an adequate model. So hopefully there'll be some advice to U.S. groups in terms of, you know, looking at the Canadian model. But more broadly, this project feeds into two others that I'm currently working on. I'm trying to put together a workshop of American and Canadian genocide scholars to meet in Winnipeg, including several Indigenous scholars, to talk about these issues more broadly, so it's not just my voice. And I'm also doing some work on using new technologies to represent residential schooling in order to, you know, try to get settlers to better connect with these issues and not to simply dismiss or avoid or be indifferent to the experiences of residential schooling. So this project feeds into some other ones I'm working on that'll hopefully have more of an applied end.
That was Andrew Wolford, professor of sociology at the University of Manitoba. The Prairie Women's Health Center of Excellence has launched its Digital Stories series, examining the intergenerational impacts of residential school. In particular, it focuses on First Nations women whose mothers are residential school survivors. Roberta Stout is a researcher in Aboriginal women's health and works with the Prairie Women's Health Center of Excellence in Winnipeg.
So this project brought together six First Nations women who were living in Winnipeg, and it was a project that took place over 3 weeks, but has extended. We started it in October last year, and we still, even as of yesterday, we got together and presented our findings, our videos. So over 3 weeks last fall, these six First Nations women came together and started to explore sort of how their mothers, who had attended residential schools, had, I guess, survived the school system, but how they had parented them as the daughters of these mothers. So it was looking at daughters of mothers who had gone to residential schools. And over the course of those 3 weeks, the daughters were then tasked with creating their own story, their own digital story, which is a 2 to 5 minute video, a short video, which looked at some of the intergenerational effects of residential schools. And a lot of them focused on the mother-daughter relationships and the disconnect from their mothers, the emotional disconnect. Other effects such as mothering, how the women themselves are now parenting, and so sort of looking at the whole spectrum of the legacy of residential schools and how it passes on between the different generations. And in this case, we looked at women specifically. So each of the women did produce their own video, and we also produced a report that sort of put together a lot of the stories that were discussed by the women over the course of those over the course of that project.
Sounds very interesting, and that's a whole lot to pack into 2 to 3 minute videos. And can you tell me what you learned through the project, and if there was anything new you learned about the effects of residential school?
I guess the one thing that we all came away with on one level is that the legacy of residential schools didn't sort of end with the children who went to them, that the legacy has continued on and has been transmitted through the different generations from that point onwards. So what our mothers had learned in the schools was then transferred to us in varying degrees, and then we have transferred that again to our children in varying degrees, or we have, and our mothers have made, you know, really strong efforts to sort of counter that, counter the assimilation or the language loss, so there, or the parenting that had resulted from being parented in a residential school by people who didn't consider themselves parents, and I wouldn't say they were fit parents if they were institutional parents. That was one learning, that the intergenerational effects are continuing. They're still there. And we also learned that through telling stories, sharing our stories, particularly the women who were involved in the project often said that no one had ever asked them what it was like to be a child of a parent who was in residential school. So there's a lot of research that has been done so far in the past several, 2 decades at least, that have looked at survivor stories. But this is this was the first time that these women weren't being asked what was it like to be parented by a survivor of a residential school. So what are the intergenerational effects? And that telling stories is healing. So the women also talked about how, for them, being involved in a project like this where they were able to share their stories for the first time with other women who had very similar life experiences that they had growing up and continue to have, that there was this a connection that was made between each other, so they felt less alone. There was more of an understanding of, you know, the aha moments where it's like, oh, now I understand why my mom was the way she was, or now I understand why I am the way I am. So there was a really strong therapeutic component to it that we didn't realize would happen. And I believe part of that is through using an arts-based approach to talking through stories. So the creation of the digital stories has been really quite healing. And then I guess the last thing I would say is how much the community has been interested in hearing the stories of the women who were involved in the project. We've had incredible take from community organizations, from educational institutes, different venues. They want to hear these stories, and then when we speak the stories, other people come and tell their stories. So there's this sort of like opening up of sharing of stories of the intergenerational effect. So it's been quite cathartic, I think, for everybody who's been involved in the project.
That was Roberta Stout, a researcher in Aboriginal women's health and works with the Prairie Women's Health Center of Excellence in Winnipeg. Now here's Austiny with Starwalker.
Sweet grass burner and a dog soldier. Hey, wa, hey, wa, hey, wa.
Holy light, guard the night. Pray up your meditation. together aim straight.
Cancer rates have been on the rise in First Nation communities over the past 4 decades. The Canadian Cancer Society is focusing on prevention and screening right now and has held its first Aboriginal symposium in Ontario aimed at prevention awareness. Shauna Pitawanakwit is the Lay Health Community Coordinator of the Canadian Cancer Society based in Ontario.
The Aboriginal Approaches to Cancer Prevention Symposium, which is being sponsored through the Canadian Cancer Society, is being hosted in Little Creek here on Manitoulin Island at the NIMI Arena or Complex.
And so why is it being held?
The main reason is that the Canadian Cancer Society Screening Saves Lives realizes the importance of screening and that the Aboriginal community has an overall rate of cancers have doubled within the First Nation community since 1968 to 2001. So as a result of that, the Canadian Cancer Society has brought this symposium to Manitoulin Island in order to engage and bring awareness to the First Nation communities here on Manitoulin Island.
And do we know why cancer is on the rise in First Nation communities?
No. Specifically, there aren't to pinpoint reasons, though we believe that cancer prevention and early detection of cancer helps reduce the mortality rate. So with First Nation communities, we're here to bring awareness about screening to the First Nation communities in order to help bring that awareness in order to look at preventive efforts and early detection of cancer among First Nation people.
And so what specifically will be talked about throughout the symposium and exactly what is it all about?
The Canadian Cancer Society Screening Saves Lives program and the Aboriginal Approaches to Cancer Prevention Symposium, what will be happening here at the Little Current Arena is that we're going to have interactive presentations, we're going to have panel discussions and workshops and engage the members of the community to learn about the importance of cancer screening, early detection, and cancer prevention. And so we also have our mini market, and we also have a giant colon with us. So through that process, the members and community will be able to access the services through the Canadian Cancer Society and what we have to offer to the First Nation communities. And at the same time, we'll have an opportunity to showcase the other local agencies and their services here on Manitoulin Island.
And has there been a lot of interest from community members to attend the symposium? And is everybody just based in your community or coming from all over Manitoulin Island and other areas?
Our target has been the 7 First Nation communities within the Manitoulin District. And we've had a good support in that way and reaching out to those communities. We've also invited other northern communities, First Nation communities and agencies, we've invited them to participate. Our main target is First Nation communities in Manitoulin. We have our Screen Saves Lives program here, so this is our target area for Manitoulin. and we've been very excited about the turnout and the response that we are getting.
Okay, and just going back to cancer rates again, and we know that cancer rates have been on the rise for the past about almost five decades now. And are there any specific types of cancer that are on the rise?
The Aboriginal Symposium is going to focus on breast, cervical, and colorectal cancer screening programs, and that's going to be our main focus. But through the mini market, the community members will be able to engage with the Canadian Cancer Society staff to learn about other types of cancer and prevention. And that will be available for community members and the general public to come out and participate in the mini market and come and see the giant colon.
Just before we go, can you share some of these prevention strategies with us?
The symposium will be targeting the cancer screening, early detection. They will be able to access some of the provincial-based screening programs. We want to promote the Ontario Breast Screening Program, the Ontario Cervical Screening Program, and the Colon Cancer Check Program.
That was Shauna Pitawanakwit, the Lay Health Community Coordinator for the Canadian Cancer Society, and she's based in Manitoulin Island, Ontario. Former Prime Minister Paul Martin has been named the first recipient of a National Aboriginal Award. The Award for Excellence in Aboriginal Relations has been presented to Martin by the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business and Sodexo Canada. Martin has been recognized for two of his initiatives, the Martin Aboriginal Education Initiative, which aims to increase Aboriginal retention at post-secondary institutions, and the CAPE Fund. Paul Martin.
You know, I'm honored. I am a huge fan of the CCAB, so I think that the work that it has done with First Nations, with the Métis Nation, with the Inuit peoples, has simply been outstanding. Its relationships with the business community are absolutely crucial. And that I think that it's a major Canadian institution, and I'm obviously honored.
All right, and you're being recognized for two of your initiatives, the Martin Aboriginal Education Initiative and the Capital for Aboriginal Prosperity and Entrepreneurship Fund. And can you tell us a bit about those?
CAPE, or the Capital for Prosperity Fund, is a $50 million fund that was raised from the major banks, mining companies, oil and gas companies, engineering companies, as well as Canada Steamship Lines. And it was done because we recognize that the availability of capital is not always there when Aboriginal entrepreneurs seek it to the same extent that it is available to others. And so we set up a private equity fund, which is independently managed, to fill a niche in that area, and they're doing very well. And it's our hope that over time other funds will be created, other people will come in and recognize that backing Aboriginal entrepreneurs is a very important thing, and it can be very profitable as well. The education project which we have recognizes that the dropout rate among Aboriginal Canadians is simply dramatically higher than it is for other Canadians, and that a substantial portion of that is really the fact that schools, Aboriginal schools in this country, are underfunded, and that many of the new innovations that are brought to education in non-Aboriginal schools have not been made available. And so for the sake of discussion, just to give you, we have a number of programs. Where there's a best practices website. We have a mentorship program with the accounting industry and with the banking industry. We're in the process of working with two schools, grade schools, which we hope will be model schools. One on the Stony Point Reserves in southwestern Ontario, another one on Walpole Island, also in southwestern Ontario. Only 2 days ago, we announced that our Aboriginal Youth Entrepreneurship Program, which is a high school program, grade 11 and 12, and which is a number of schools right across the country in all of the four western provinces, in Ontario, at Laurentian University, in Rexton, in New Brunswick. And we just brought forth a grade 11 and a grade 12 workbook and a grade 11 and grade 12 teachers resource book, which we think is probably one of the best high school business programs that you're going to get anywhere in North America. And it is the first one, are these workbooks, which are based totally on Aboriginal traditions, Aboriginal beliefs, and which the role models are all Aboriginals. So those are the kinds of things that we're doing, and we're very proud. I don't regard this award as being given to me alone. This is given to all of the people who are working either in CAPE or in the Aboriginal Initiative, the Education Initiative, the teachers who are out there teaching the courses, and the students who've contributed so much.
Why have you decided to invest yourself in Aboriginal entrepreneurship and education, and why do these things matter to you?
Well, I think that this is, I really think that the issues that we're talking about in terms of Aboriginal Canada, these are among the most important social issues and the most important economic issues in the country. We're talking about the youngest, fastest growing segment of our population. And the fact is that Canada hasn't stood up and dealt with them properly. And it was a tragedy that Kelowna was not carried through with. This was the first time that the federal government, the provinces and the territories and the Aboriginal leadership sat down to deal with issues like health care and with education. And when I stepped down from government, I said, look, this is simply too important an issue. It's one I've been involved in for all my life, long before I went into public life. I was active with the CCAB. I just don't think there's any way, shape, or form that we can talk about Canadian values without facing up to this issue and working with the Aboriginal leadership and with Aboriginal Canadians to deal with what are, in many cases, human tragedies, but even more to the point, just unfulfilled opportunities for a very young and dynamic generation.
You've been at this for a few years, and so can you tell us quickly about one or two of the success stories that have come from either one of your initiatives?
Sure. In terms of CAPE, a company called Manitoba Mucklucks in Winnipeg, which is really, you know, now selling, you know, very high fashion mucklucks. The market has been incredibly receptive to it, and I would recommend it to you and anybody else who's listening, that they rush out tomorrow and buy Manitoba Mucklucks. But that's one of the companies that we're backing, as well as One Earth Farms, I think, which is well known certainly in Western Canada, in which we are a participant. As far as our school programs are concerned, there are a number, but I just because of these new workbooks, these new study books that we're coming out with, which are unique, I think, in the world, the Youth Entrepreneurship Program is certainly one that I would point to. But, you know, I'd say the same thing for the model school. I think the same thing for the mentorship program and for the website. I'm just very proud of all of the work that so many people have put into this.
That was the Right Honorable Paul Martin. Now here's Alyssa Bay Isaac with There Will Be Stars. Ashoka International has launched its Changemakers initiative. Alicia Muscat is the executive director of the organization, and she'll tell us what that initiative is all about.
So the Ashoka Changemakers initiative is a way for us with a number of our partners to find out about ideas and projects that are happening in the field of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit learning across Canada, and to help those ideas and projects to get exposure, access to some additional resources like funding and networks, and to share those with all the people who are interested in learning more about the field.
And so why was that initiative launched?
So we at Ashoka Canada have been focused on helping social entrepreneurs scale up their solutions to make systemic change. And when we looked at who the social entrepreneurs are or the Ashoka Fellows that we work with, we definitely noticed that we wanted to be working more with Aboriginal peoples in Canada. We had identified it as a priority, and then some of the other partners that we're working with, the McConnell Foundation, the Counseling Foundation, RBC Foundation, and I can name the others for you as well. We're also looking at working more with these populations in a way that we felt would be respectful in our position as non-Aboriginal organizations. So by working with other Aboriginal partners to highlight what's happening as opposed to in any way propose what we think should be happening, because we don't know what those things are.
So what does it entail, or how does it work?
The way the Changemakers Initiative works is that we have a website that's live. It's www.changemakers.com/FNMI-learning, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit Learning. And you can go to that site right now and nominate any projects that you know of that fit the space. So that has to do with learning inside or outside the classroom, all the way from early education through to post-secondary and career learning. And then as of October 26th, people can start submitting any ideas or projects that they're working on. And then for the next 3 months, we'll be reviewing those entries, and then through a selection process that involves a jury of expert judges who are all First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, we'll be selecting the top projects and then distributing awards to those, ranging from $500 to $5,000, recognizing the projects that are most innovative, have the greatest potential for social impact, and the potential to be sustainable. And then at the end of all of that, we'll be convening the award winners as well as the partners and a number of funders and other interested people at a summit, and that'll be in April of 2012, where we want to give people the opportunity to get to know each other, to expose their work or to learn about other work, and then to set the path going forward.
All right, and why don't you tell me a little bit about Ashoka now?
Sure. So Ashoka is a global organization, and we've been around for 30 years, and we've been in Canada since 2002. And Ashoka's vision is to create a world where everyone is a change maker, so where people give themselves the permission and they have the societal support to address social challenges that they see in their communities or in the world around them. The primary way we've been doing this over the past 30 years is by electing social entrepreneurs, so people who have new ideas to make large-scale social change and have entrepreneurial personalities and qualities to make them happen. And we've elected them as Ashoka Fellows. We have over 2,700 fellows in 72 countries, and we have 38 Ashoka Fellows in Canada. One example of an Ashoka Fellow is Cindy Blackstock of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, and we see her work really changing the currently discriminatory policies between First Nations and non-First Nations children in the areas of education and health. So it's that level of work that we look for around the world to really address the most urgent social challenges, and then to invite everybody to participate in that kind of change.
That was Alicia Muscat, Executive Director of Ashoka Canada. You've been listening to Bombsidaw with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsidaw is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsidaw means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsedaw.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsidaw.